In the epilogue to his book, The Discarded Image, An Introduction to Medieval and Renaissance Literature, C.S. Lewis wrote, "I have made no serious effort to hide the fact that the old medieval model of the universe delights me, as I believe it delighted our ancestors. Few constructions of the imagination seem to me to have combined splendor, sobriety, and coherence to the same degree. It is possible that some readers have long been itching to remind me that it has a serious defect." It was not true. This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Last week, the annual Wyoming School of Catholic Thought was held here in Lander. Our topic was Beauty is Truth, Science and the Catholic Imagination. Our readings in science, philosophy, theology, and literature considered this question of how we see the world, how we image it, even before we think about it. That began with a look at medieval science and cosmology. The group read and discussed Chapter 5 in the epilogue of Lewis's Discarded Image, guided by Dr. Tiffany Schubert, who offered this introduction to the topic.
So I've passed out a handout, and I just want to look the first three quotations there. I really want us to keep in mind as we're moving forward in this talk.
Absence of haphazard and conduciveness of everything to an end are to be found in nature's works in the highest degree, and the resultant end of her generations and combinations is a form of the beautiful, from Aristotle's The Parts of an Animal. Science banishes purpose, teleology, design, and thus their well-understood causes, desire, and belief, from Alex Rosen's essay, Scientism versus the Theory of Mind. We must recognize that what has been called a taste in universes is not only pardonable, but inevitable. C.S. Lewis from The Discarded Image.
Thank you. Okay, wonderful. So, I want you to keep the music, right, as the imaginative, kind of working out of the medieval cosmos, keep these three quotations in mind as we go forward, as I think they really nicely summarize the two competing visions of the medieval cosmos and the modern cosmos, and I think possibly the third, or the alternative that Lewis seems to suggest to us. Okay, before I get really fully, completely started, I should just say that I am delighted to be here and also utterly unqualified to be here. I, like Dr. Glenn, am a literature person, a poetry person, and so science is most certainly outside of my realm. But I'm here today to talk to you about medieval science, right, which is old and wrong, so it's okay. And I'm also gonna be talking to you about really the medieval science that matters to the poets, let's be honest, right? So this will be my primary focus, and also science in its imaginative and emotional effect. All right, so thank goodness, right, there are a lot of barriers between me and actual science. So I'm feeling pretty good. Okay, so there's this moment in Ivan Turgenev's 1862 novel, Fathers and Children, where Bazarov, a dark and brooding medical student and tortured nihilist, is resting under a haystack musing on life. Confident yet conflicted, contemptuous yet charismatic, Bazarov is a man of science, fond of pronouncements like, "Nature's not a temple, but a workshop where man's the laborer." What about those mysterious relations between a man and a woman? We physiologists understand all that. You just study the anatomy of the eye. Why do I like chemistry? Why do you like apples? As a result of our sensations. I'll cut the frogs open and look inside to see what's going on, since you and I are just like frogs, except that we walk on two legs. I'll find out what's going on inside us as well. And my personal favorite, a decent chemist is 20 times more useful than any poet. Which, he's kind of got a point. Right, so in many ways, Bazarov is the modern scientist described by Leon Cass, the man who reduces holes to parts. Right, love for Bazarov is reduced to ocular anatomy. The man who dismisses appearances, the external, right, for the internal. After all, frogs and human beings are the same on the insides, so they must be the same simply, right, except for, you know, the whole two legs thing. The man who denies teleology, a preference for apples or even for chemistry itself, right, the thing that Bazarov is interested in, has no orientation towards the noble, the beautiful, or the good, but it simply arises from chemical sensations. He's also the man who favors useful activity over leisurely indulgence. Now, at times, Bazarov's reductive science in this novel is almost laughable. His pithy aphorisms verge on caricature. Yet there, at the haystack, Bazarov poignantly articulates the imaginative and emotional response to modern science, the response that C.S. Lewis is so interested in. In a moment of uncharacteristic vulnerability, Bazarov confides to his impressionable young friend, Arkady. Here I lie under a haystack. The tiny space I occupy is so small compared to the rest of space, where I am not, and where things have nothing to do with me. And the amount of time in which I get to live my life is so insignificant compared to eternity, where I've never been and won't ever be. Yet in this atom, this mathematical point, blood circulates, a brain functions, and desires something as well. How absurd, what nonsense. This is an astonishingly modern emotional experience, to feel staggeringly small in the face of the vastness of space. And note there Bazarov's use of space rather than the medieval heavens. Right? That's a major emotional imaginative shift. It's also very modern to feel the indifference of the cosmos, whereas Bazarov says, where things have nothing to do with me. All those alien stars coming into being and passing away, ignorant and indifferent to our joys and agonies. In comparison to space, man is an atom, a mere mathematical point. And yet he also has a brain that works and desires, that wants things in spite of its smallness. There is something absurd about this, right? About a speck of sand that has intentions and desires in the face of the magnitude of the ocean. To use the scientific language of Rosenberg's piece, Bazarov acknowledges the persistence of the theory of the mind, but feels the weight of scientism, of the morally indifferent universe that science is presenting to him. I suspect that Bazarov's emotions make sense to us, even if we are Christians who believe in creation and providence, who think we live in a cosmos of intentionality, right, of purpose and of beauty. I know that I have felt my own smallness weigh on me, and the absurdity of my own plans and desires compared to the immense indifference of space and time. What do multiple galaxies care if I wear this outfit, marry this man, get this job? This is one of the emotional and imaginative legacies of modern science, of the image of the cosmos that has been impressed upon our minds and hearts. And it's this emotional imaginative effect of the medieval model that I and Lewis are most interested in. The reading, I hope, gave you a taste for the strangeness of the medieval model, right, with its four contraries, its four elements hierarchically arranged with the individual characteristics, the influence of the planets. Again, hopefully the music sort of gave you a little bit of a flavor, right, of the different influences there. I like to think of the influence of Saturn, right, as something as seasonal depression on steroids. Right? Good. The medieval cosmos is this strange blend of philosophy and theology with science, right? And you've got angelic intelligences associated with each planet, right? What respectable science these days would say anything remotely like that at all, right? I would assume you'd be laughed out of the room. So, we're going to delve deeper into this cosmos and into its details. But what I'm especially interested in, right, is the way that we create out of science, right, a model of the cosmos, and the way that that model has an imaginative and emotional effect on us. Now, in some ways, what's interesting about the medieval cosmos versus the modern model is not the difference, but actually the similarity. As Lewis notes, the medievals knew that the Earth was, by cosmic standards, a point. It had no appreciable magnitude. Remember Bazarov's use of the language of point, right, to describe himself. And as Lewis points out, that while the Earth is at the center of the cosmos, it's really on the outside. The black sheep of the spherical family, the uninvited guest, the celestial party. A position that could suggest a cosmos where things have nothing to do with me. Right, there's some vague modern sense that the geocentricism of the ancient and medieval world was hubristic, sort of man claiming to be the center of all, a king of the universe. But in fact, that center position is really nothing to brag about. We're below the moon, which we'll talk about in a minute. which right in the medieval model is this barrier between the perishable and the imperishable, the eternal and the temporal, the ether and the air, the perfect and the imperfect. So actually, we earthbound creatures are cut off from what Lewis calls this admirable universe, sinless and perfect. So in a sense, we don't belong. But as Lewis points out, all sense of the bathless, of the pathless, the baffling, and the utterly alien, all agoraphobia, is so markedly absent from medieval poetry when it leads us, as so often, into the sky. So the medieval cosmos, despite its realization, right, of the tininess, right, of the smallness of the earth, despite its placing of earth at the center as a not as a mark, right, of approbation, but really a kind of condemnation, right, or at least the degradation of the earth, despite all that, doesn't produce Bazarov's cosmic anxiety. For there are striking differences between the medieval and the modern cosmos, differences that are central to this imaginative and emotional response. And so I want to spend some time talking about these differences. So Lewis writes, "The medieval universe, while unimaginably large, was also unambiguously finite." And I think this is the sort of the first difference that's really central in understanding the imaginative and emotional difference. It is that modern science teaches us that the cosmos is infinitely expanding, the way spilled water or oil expands, expanding with no particular purpose or shape. Lewis actually will use the image of the shoreless sea to describe this cosmos. The medieval cosmos is more like a perfect Russian nesting doll, a crystal sphere tucked within crystal sphere. Right. The medieval cosmos, right, is a shaped thing. Right? It is formed. That is, shaped spheres within spheres. The earth is at the center. You move up then through the seven planets to the sphere of the fixed stars. Right? So the stars as we know them, right? The stars are fixed, right, because they move in a set pattern, unlike the planets, which are sort of wander, which is a little bit inconvenient for your theory, but it's okay because we have complicated ways of explaining planetary movement, so it's okay. Don't worry too much about it. Then we move out of the firmament into the crystalline sphere. The crystalline sphere is here part because in Genesis we have that dividing of the waters, right? The firmament divides the waters below, the waters above. So the crystalline sphere, these are the waters above the firmament, and they apparently sort of congealed into a kind of crystal-like structure. And above that, we've got the prima mobile, which is the sphere that is the mover of all of the other spheres. And then outside of that is the heavens. So sphere within sphere, the whole thing, right, perfectly shaped and sphered. So this difference in shape, I think, makes a significant difference in emotional effect. Infinity cows us. Perhaps it is, again, the seeming lack of purpose or intentionality that it can convey. I think about the way that we ourselves are constantly looking for shapes, right? The shapes that we discover in clouds, which is maybe a kind of imposition of our desire for shape on something that is shapeless, but there's something in us that longs for shape. Shape is comforting. Rosenberg tells us, right, that the universe is completely devoid of purpose, everywhere and at every level of organism, including us. And I think that such a view of the universe is at least emotionally easier to accept when we see the universe as infinite, right, as this perpetually expanding sea, mostly inhospitable to human life. When we see it, right, as this really intricately shaped sphere within sphere within sphere, right, that seems to suggest, right, purpose and intentionality. And a shape suggests a shaper. And of course, the medieval saw God as shaping the universe in accordance with the laws of geometry, the laws of music. Right? So there's actually something kind of really lovely about this image, right, of God sort of shaping, right, this whole world. So I think that sense of shape has this kind of comfort to it. And within this shape, right, Earth has a definite spot. Motionless at the center, but also it's at the bottom. It's a position that the modern cosmos, or its formlessness, really lacks. Right. Here you can see this is an image of Dante's Commedia, but it really shows us Earth, right? Earth at the bottom, and then moving up right through all of the other planets, right? So Earth is there up at the bottom. But what that means is, as Lewis points out, is that there's a real up and down in the medieval cosmos, right? You are, in fact, there actually is a bottom, right? And there actually is a top. And as Lewis says, right, he calls it that special word, height. And like shape, height orients us. It's the difference, I think, between being submerged and endlessly tossed about in deep water and walking through a structure like the Pantheon in Rome. This Pantheon here, right? I mean, right, you walk into the Pantheon and what do? Immediately, you look up, you can't help it. And as we move up higher and higher in the medieval cosmos, we move from lesser perfection to greater perfection. Is you're moving from, right, terra regio, right, so earth, up to water, up to air, up to fire, right? So as you move upward, you're moving up to higher and higher, more perfect, more pure elements. So that height is not is kind of a neutral thing, like, you know, look, you're taller than I am, that's cool, but it means you're more perfect than I am. So there may be, some sort of cosmological reason for a preference for supermodels being like over 6 feet tall, right? And you know, I think in this sense of height here, the medieval universe is more natural. It's more based on, more natural in the sense of more based on our appearances or experiences. The kind of perspective that Cass is really urging us to adopt for science, because our everyday experiences assures us that we are in fact actually looking up at the stars. I do actually have to lift my head up to look at the stars, whether there is an up or a down. So I think with Cass, we can ask why we have that sensation and what it suggests, even if we can't really talk about the cosmos having an up and a down. Right? As human beings, we have to look up to see, right, why do we do this? What effect does it have on us to be the kind of being who does experience, right, this upward looking? So the medieval cosmos has a definite shape, it has height, and it's full of light and music. Okay, so medieval cosmos, full of light, full of music. Lewis writes, nothing is more deeply impressed in the cosmic imaginings of a modern than the idea that the heavenly bodies move in a pitch black, and dead cold vacuity. This is even more so because we have even more pictures, of the cosmos than Lewis did when he's writing Discarded Image in 1964. I mean, there's something like really quite beautiful about these images, but the blackness there, right, is so, right, impressed upon our imagination. And as Lewis points out, in fact, in the Middle Ages, in the medieval cosmos, you would think of the heavens as actually being illuminated, right, because the sun is shedding its light on all throughout. So you're not actually looking up at darkness, you're looking up at light. And looking up at light that is making music, right? The music of the spheres. Right? There's that, if you know Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, there's that really famous passage in Merchant of Venice. It's Lorenzo talking to Jessica, and he's describing the music of the spheres. It says, there's not the smallest orb which thou behold'st, but in his motion, like an angel, sings, still choiring to the young-eyed cherubins. Such harmony is in immortal souls, but whilst this muddy vesture of decay doth grossly close it in, we cannot hear. Right. So the planets are actually putting on a concert that we, rubes that we are, can't appreciate. But simply the knowledge that there is this music of the spheres, right, I think actually also adds to that sense of comfort in the medieval cosmos. Right? It's not utter silence, even if we can't actually hear it. And this entire cosmos is infused with desire. So modern science talks of the laws of nature, physics, or natural selection, or chance. Medieval science talks about desire. And Lewis argues that while law and desire are both metaphorical, on the imaginative and emotional level, it makes a great difference whether with the medieval, I love this, we project upon the universe our strivings and desires, or with the moderns our police system and traffic regulations. Lewis was not a big fan of like a lot of laws, right, and a lot of government interference. So I think some of that is sort of coming out here in this moment. Desire does something different to our emotions and imaginations than law, because desire is so close to love. According to Edmund Spenser, an Elizabethan poet who still lived in the shadow of the medieval cosmos, right? The medieval cosmos goes for a long, long time. Spenser says that the four elements were originally at war. Air hated earth, and water hated fire, till love relented their rebellious ire. So love brings about this cosmic harmony, right, built into the very physical construction of the medieval cosmos, right, is love. And according to Spenser, love did place them, the elements, all in order and compel to keep themselves within their sundry reins. So love establishes order by putting each element, and indeed every facet of the cosmos, in its proper place, and every object actually desires to be in its proper place, right? Whether that desire is metaphorical or literal. And this idea of love kind of creating peace between warring elements, has a lot of longevity, right? You actually find it in Alexander Pope's essay on man, even, right? So as late as the 18th century, we still have this idea sort of lingering, right? That love is actually creating the order, the physical, material order in the cosmos. Right, and then every object in that cosmos wants to be where it is, in some sense, right? Metaphorical sense. That rocks desire to want to be on the ground, fire desires to be below the moon. Right, and even if they aren't, again, consciously desiring, and there's different philosophical, theological ways that we can talk about what's happening with that desire, but I'm not going to go into that. I think there's something delightful to the imagination in the thought that the rock firmly lodged in the ground has a kind of contentment, right? Happy to be where it is, and in fact would be displeased to find itself perpetually suspended in motion, in midair. Now, in the medieval cosmos, desire is the impetus not just behind place, not just where you are, but also behind motion. And so motion is infused by desire, by love. It's not a mechanical obedience to the laws of physics, whatever that means, because obviously that's also metaphorical language. But motion is a reflection of a kind of inner motivation, of desire and love. And indeed, given the connection between motion and love, Earth's motionlessness in the Ptolemaic cosmos should actually just strike us as disturbing. Right? It doesn't move. But movement, right, is actually a reflection of desire. Now in the Commedia, Dante frequently uses motion to express love for God. Near the end of his journey, Dante the pilgrim beholds God as a point surrounded by nine circles of light. Beatrice, who is Dante's guide through paradise at this point, informs him, observe the circle nearest it, meaning God, and understand its motion is so swift because it is spurred on by flaming love. This celestial movement is an inversion of the movement of the planets. When Dante sees this, he says, in the world of sense we see, the farther from the center they revolve, the more divinity is in their orbits. So in the world of sense, Earth, not God, is the center. And the planets furthest from the center move the most quickly and are the most perfect rather than the closest to it. So there's an inversion between the sensory model and the intelligible model, the model of heaven. But nevertheless, in both models, we see desire and motion intimately connected to each other. In both models, it's that the faster that something is moving, the closer it is to God, whether that be the planets that are far away from Earth, or the angels closest to God. Right? So the fast to God, excuse me, there's only one God in the medieval cosmos, despite what sometimes the planetology seems to suggest, only one God, all circling fast straight around that single point. So that motion, whether it's planetary, or angelic, is directed towards God, who in the end is the true center of the cosmos. So the whole medieval order is erotic. The delicate order of all of the elements is made possible by desire for that order, and ultimately all order to and removing in response to the highest object of love, God himself. In the medieval model, we see what Lewis calls the revelry of insatiable love. Now, all this talk of desire and love suggests a universe of purpose. Even if desire is metaphorical language for plants and rocks, though obviously literal, and they do mean it literally, right, for the angelic beings associated with the planets, again, they do mean this literally, the angel part, right, with each planet, connotes this whole language of desire, right, connotes something more than chance or accident. It suggests a telos, an end to be desired. Remember that first quote that we read from Aristotle? Absence of haphazard and conduciveness of everything to an end are to be found in nature's work in the highest degrees. The highest degrees. Okay, so everything in the medieval universe, right, has a purpose, has an end, has a goal. Right, nothing is haphazardly done, nothing by chance. This is so strikingly different, right, from what Deconinck tells us. That ever since Darwin, the opinion remains prevalent that the notion of purpose in science is unscientific and unnecessary. I think that would have been unintelligible to most medievals, to say that the idea of purpose is unscientific. I don't know how they would imagine a science without purpose. So nature is full of purpose for the medievals, and it's also full of correspondence. So there's a likeness between the parts of nature, and man is at the center of this likeness because man is, as the medievals were very fond of saying, a microcosm of the macrocosm, right? So man embodies in himself all aspects of the universe in some form. Right? Man is feet on the ground, on the earth, head in the heavens. He incorporates all of the objects below him, right? So rocks have existence, vegetables have existence and growth, animals have existence, growth, and sensation, and man has existence, growth, sensation, and reason. So he takes up all the lower parts of the cosmos are taken up into man himself. But then, through his reason, he's going to rise up to the angels, all right? To rise up to this intellectual grasp, this intellectual beholding of God. So in the medieval cosmos, man is clearly not a speck, right, in the vast space that has nothing to do with him. And, right, so that Bazarov's sense of alienation from the universe doesn't really make a lot of sense to the medieval imagination because they understand man as being made of the cosmos. Made of the cosmos, participating in the dance of the cosmos. This is perhaps one of my favorite images in the medieval imagination. There's this idea that the planets are actually dancing in their movements, the commonplace in the Middle Ages. So just as you've got the music of the spheres, they're sort of making the music and they're dancing to the music as they move. Isidore of Seville, he's the author of the Etymologia, which is a wildly popular medieval encyclopedia, right? Yes, they had encyclopedias in the Middle Ages. They loved encyclopedias. They loved to just, like, catalog lots of really, really weird things. Is mostly what medieval encyclopedias are. But he wrote, "For the universe itself is said to have been framed by a kind of harmony of sounds, and the heaven itself revolves under the tones of that harmony." Right? So revolving under the tones, it's dancing. Dancing under the tones. And not only is the universe built on music, it moves to music. Right? E.M. Tilliard summarizes one Elizabethan presentation of the cosmic dance. Time and all its divisions are a dance. Stars have their own dance. The sun courts the earth. Right? In a dance, the different elements have their different measures. The very planets and stones are in some sort included. Again, I think this would sound very strange to a modern scientist, especially, right, of a Rosenberg style scientist, right, to talk about, right, the dancing of the cosmos, right. But for the medieval, this is profoundly important. In his 1596 poem Orchestra, Sir John Davies has one character urge another to dance. "Imitate heaven, whose beauties excellent are in continual motion day and night." Right. So man's dancing, and indeed that's not just his actual dancing, but all of his actions are an imitation of the planetary dance. Right? It's a copy of this heavenly party. So all these differences explain why Earth's outsider status did not fill the medieval with dread or anxiety or agoraphobia. Bazarov is looking up at a dark, cold, silent, indifferent space. The medieval is looking up at a perfectly spherical, bright, musical, loving, dancing heaven, a heaven that he in part resembles. Modern man is, in Lewis's words, like one looking out from the saloon entrance onto the dark Atlantic. So think again, right, of that Caspar David Friedrich picture, right, of the monk looking out at that sea. So, like one looking out from the saloon entrance on the dark Atlantic, or from the lighted porch upon dark and lonely moors. But if you accepted the medieval model, you would feel like one looking in. The earth is outside the city wall. When the sun is up, he dazzles us and we cannot see inside. Darkness, our own darkness, draws the veil and we catch a glimpse of the high pomp within. The vast lighted concavity filled with music and the revelry of insatiable love. When I first learned about the medieval cosmos, I was filled with longing. Right, longing to live in such a model that seems so much more hospitable and festive than the modern model. It seemed, well, cozier and more imaginatively colorful. I love the idea, right, that the planets have personalities. Jovial Jupiter and morose Saturn, silver-tongued Mercury and fecund Venus. And those planets had a kind of agency, an influence upon the fates of man. All was not, in De Koninck's words, aimless process determined only by the material in the way a landslide occurs. There's something particularly imaginatively evocative or hospitable about a landslide. The medieval model was a model in which everything had meaning, in which everything was itself and also a sign for something else. Nothing could be further from the modern cosmos of chance and accident, of a universe completely devoid of purpose. What a poetic science. I thought, this is great for me. This is the kind of science that I want. It was a beautiful model that suited my tastes. But, as Lewis Bluntly points out, it's wrong. Right, Lewis is no fool, and hopefully neither am I, clinging to some mythical medieval science. The world is heliocentric, not geocentric, which is a point, as a medievalist, like I sometimes occasionally forget and sort of have to remind myself, right, what is it now? Again, kind of want to be in that, right? Have that taste for the medieval cosmos. The planets are not, as Aristotle thought, ungenerate, imperishable, and eternal. Stars can die, nor do the planets move in perfect circles. Though, of course, actually, the medievals did eventually. That was, of course, realized well before the Middle Ages actually happened. But anyways, we know that they don't move in perfect circles. We're very keenly aware of that now. The chemical composition of the world is infinitely more complex than the four elements. Just think of the periodic table. And the genes that we are born with probably influence our lives far more than the planets do at our birth. But the beautiful has a life of its own beyond empirical truth or correspondence to objective reality, I think as Keats suggests. Works of the imagination can in themselves delight us, and delight is no small gift. Especially in the right, in a world as the medievals would have seen it as a, right, this veil of tears. Delight is no small gift. But we have to go further than saying that the medieval model was a quaint work of the imagination and the modern model a work of empirical observation. No model is a catalog of ultimate realities, and none is a mere fantasy, Lewis declares. And I think that this realization is central to our response to scientific models, whether medieval or modern. So, what exactly are these scientific models, according to Lewis? So now I'm going to shift out of talking about the medieval cosmos and into to Lewis's discussion in the epilogue to The Discarded Image. And I'd like to spend some time discussing his image of the stencil. Right? And he uses that image of the stencil to draw our attention to the partiality of scientific inquiry. A stencil, just imagine a stencil, it has a definite shape. It has a unique identity with distinct contours, but it gives that shape through exclusion. Think of all of the empty page that is left out of the final image when you use a stencil. Now, there's an aesthetic quality to this. A stencil is a tool employed by an artist. Stencils are really, they're really helpful, especially right, if you're like me and you really can't draw. It's nice to have a stencil. And they can facilitate the creation of something beautiful, but something incomplete. No scientific model can capture the whole page. I keep jumping ahead to De Koninck, but I just found him really helpful for thinking about this topic. Right, he talks about modern biologists who cling to the Cartesian idea of understanding the complex in terms of the less complex, which leads them to insist on a kind of understanding of life by looking not at plants or horses or man, but at an amoeba. This is a kind of stencil that has allowed modern biologists to know far more about microscopic organisms, right, than the medieval did, but has perhaps led some to overlook the unique organism that is man, which is something that the medieval model does not do. Cass, I think, rightly points out that the stencil so often used by modern science is internal and particular, rather than external and whole. And he calls for a more beautiful, more natural science, more closely tied to our experience and to our appearances, right? To peacock feathers, to tigers, to blushes. That sounds, actually sort of sounds like a medieval bestiary. I think the medievals probably would have really loved that part of Cass. We need a science that is open to purpose and end. But in a sense, that's just switching one stencil for another. One stencil may be better than another, more humane perhaps, at least for a particular reason. But we're still looking through stencils. After all, the focus on the external and whole, on purpose, on the good, does not in and of itself guarantee a true science. The medieval model, wholly alive to purpose, was obviously wrong about many things. And these stencils are shaped by the temper of the age. And here I think this is a really, really important argument to at least wrestle with in Lewis. So I want to consider the other image that Lewis uses in the epilogue. And it's the image of the cross-examiner. So now we're going into court. To the scientist, nature is a witness on the stand. And as he says, a good cross-examiner can do wonders. Scientists, through their persistent and penetrating questions, can elicit much from nature. But, Lewis cautions, nature gives most of her evidence in answer to the questions we ask of her. Right? Nature is kind of... Well, she's so often right, depicted as a woman, right? And women just don't go around revealing everything to anybody. Right? You have to ask. Right? She doesn't answer unasked questions. And those unasked questions may be very large in number. And the questions that are asked are, at least in part, I think, influenced by the interests and prejudice of our age and even the definitions we have for the objects or concepts that we are asking about. In his magisterial work, The Gene, An Intimate History, Siddhartha Mukherjee talks about finding genes for various human features. He says, if we define beauty as having blue eyes and only blue eyes, then we will indeed find a gene for beauty. If we define intelligence as the performance on only one kind of problem and only one kind of test, then we will indeed find a gene for intelligence. The genome is only a mirror for the breadth or narrowness of human imagination. Our imagination can shape what we find, even in our genes. Now, there might be ways of correcting that, right? Better ways of looking at the genome. But I think that there's an insight there, right, about how we define things shapes what we find when we go out looking for those things. Right? And certainly, I think this is very much what Lewis has in mind. So these questions, right, that the scientists are asking are going to be shaped by their interest in wholes or particulars, in insides and outsides, maybe even, I'd say, the politics, the theology, and the poetry of the moment. A monarchical age is, in fact, inclined to a hierarchical universe, but in a democratic age is more inclined to a more democratic universe. And Lewis wants to really caution us from rushing to the conclusion that science determines the politics. He says it's not a one-way street, that scientists are historical creatures capable of being influenced by their historical periods. And that would include the questions that we are willing to ask of the natural world, right? And the definitions that we bring to that project. Right? Lewis makes, I think, to me it seems a very radical claim that scientific models are not discarded simply because new scientific evidence arises. But because of a change in mood and taste, we get a little tired of a certain kind of science, we sort of move on, right? That the human spirit has our impulses, not merely scientific, that actually shape what happens in science. So in the end, I think that Lewis is sort of suggesting to us that scientists are not simply neutral creatures, objectively looking at the world around them. They are shaped, right, by their cultures, right, by the temper and the mood of the age. And I say this, and Lewis as well, right, says this, it's not a skepticism of science. Okay? Lewis is no reactionary. He was often accused of that, but he in fact actually embraced science. It's not a skepticism of science, but an acknowledgement of the limitations of any human activity to grasp the fullness of reality. I think maybe I'm getting in dangerous ground here, but I think that we could make similar points about most philosophical systems as well. So, in the end, what do we do with these different models, right? What good are they? I mean, first off, I think they're just really helpful in shaping our historical imagination. Right, I hope you sort of got just a little bit of a flavor of what it was like to be a medieval by learning about the medieval cosmos. I think we can learn something about our own age too, right, if we attend to our modern model, not just right from a scientific standpoint, but sort of thinking about what does it reveal about who we are as human beings. And by seeing beauty in these different models, I think we are opening ourselves up to an emotional and imaginative education. And as a literature person, right, I'm inclined to be in favor of anything that enriches our emotional and imaginative life, that strengthens those essential human faculties. Right? We don't really give them a lot of time in the gym, you could say, right? Do we work out our imagination? So I think that something that does that is really beneficial. I think where the vast horizonless sea that is the modern cosmos may elicit a kind of terrible awe, right? That beauty that seems maybe close to terror. Educating our souls in emotion that in a particular emotion that actually I think is kind of difficult for a secular modern to experience. And there is something beautiful, perhaps overwhelmingly so, right, about right, this modern romantic cosmos. And I think this is actually something that I missed when I was longing for the medieval cosmos. I was too quick to sort of reject the modern as being just, you know, utterly ugly. And I think there may even be a spiritual benefit in imaginatively surrendering to different models. Perhaps a sense of being at home and not at home in the cosmos is beneficial. There is an emotional potency in experiencing one's smallness in the face of the universe, of being dwarfed by the vastness of space and the number of stars and galaxies, an emotional experience that may not be utterly useless to the Christian. It might help intensify our sense of ourselves as pilgrims. And the medieval model reminds us that we are at home in the cosmos, that we respond to it in very deep ways. And being aware of multiple models has made me cautious about giving my emotional, imaginative, and intellectual devotion exclusively and eternally to only one model. No model has no truth, but no model has all truth. Again, Lewis is not advocating, nor am I, a rejection or a radical skepticism of science. I have my vaccines. But a healthy reluctance to treat any scientific model as permanently true or more authentically Christian, to tie confidence in faith to certain objective scientific proof. Think where that simply being aware of the historical movement of these scientific models obviates both total embrace and utter rejection of science. If I accept a single model as definitive proof of or the full expression of my faith will suffer when that model is challenged. Geocentric world proves Christianity is true. Geocentricism is not true, therefore Christianity, right, is not true. That's a problem. On the other hand, if I don't see scientific models as models, I might be tempted to reject not a particular scientific model or discovery, but science itself when it ever appears to challenge my faith. Right? Evolution, right, seems to challenge Genesis. Therefore, right, evolution and also all of science, right, is not true. So I think with Lewis's stencil approach, I avoid the dangers of total secularism and also religious fundamentalism. And seeing science as in part the employment of different stencils or the creation of different models can also inspire our wonder at the rich variety, the endless potential of nature, who, as Lewis says, personalizing her as the medievals would do, has all sorts of phenomena in stock and can suit many different tastes. Nature has many stories to share, and the history of science seems to be in part uncovering those stories. By reading more than one story, I start to see better that richness. The richness of nature ensures that we never reach the end, I think, either of science or of storytelling. And I actually think that that's really kind of marvelous. I don't think I really want to reach the end of either of those things. And then that richness, at least to a Christian, should increase our wonder at the creator of such manifold cosmos. I think we could think of the way that scripture incorporates many genres, history, lyric poetry, parables, letters, allegory, to appeal to many tastes. Perhaps the second book of Revelation is just as varied. Okay, so to conclude, the best in this kind are but shadows, runs Lewis's epigraph. to the epilogue of the discarded image. This is a line from Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. This is Theseus, the speaker. He's the ruler of Athens, and he's watching a play, a bumbling and botched performance of the doomed romance of Pyramus and Thisbe, which is the classical version of Romeo and Juliet. It's one of Shakespeare's funniest scenes, right? If you haven't, you have to go see this play. One of the actors plays a wall and has a speech informing the audience that he's playing a wall. Right, it's just, right, it just keeps going like that. It's great. Theseus's wife, who is watching him with him, she turns to her husband and says, "This is the silliest stuff that ever I heard." And in response, he says that even the best plays are but shadows. Now, the medieval and the modern models are not the silliest stuff that we have ever heard of, despite how silly the medieval sounds to the modern, right? Perhaps they are the best of their kind. Deep efforts to understand the manifold and elusive richness of the natural world, efforts that have had profound emotional and imaginative impact. But even the best scientific models are but shadows, only partial representations of the rich and mysterious depths of nature. And ultimately, for the medieval, shadows of the fullness of the spiritual reality. For all of Dante's delight in the architecture of the heavens, he sees it as a copy of the original. His whole planetary journey is a condescension to the limits of human intellect and imagination. And it's only at the end of the Commedia that he has a glimpse of the true structure of the universe and the true heaven. So those who believed in the medieval model also believed in something more than that model. Science, what they would have probably called natural philosophy, was not the last word. The Commedia ends with Dante moving from the copy to the original. In the end, right, he revolves like a planet, but he revolves not around stationary Earth, he's revolving around God. So he's actually right, he sort of left this cosmos behind in a sense, right, and entered into the true and the real cosmos, where God is, as Lewis said, really the center of all, the quarry to whom all of these untiring huntsmen pursue, the candle to whom all of these moths move yet are not burnt. So at the end of his poem, Dante moves from the natural to the angelic dance, from the shadow to reality. So our scientific models, some of the best shadows that the human mind has created, can capture, I think, neither the fullness of nature nor of supernature. But boy, what beautiful shadows we can make. Thank you.
While it's impossible to present the entirety of the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought via podcast, much of what was said and learned happened in seminars, the next several podcasts will present some of the lectures from the school. We hope that they'll be stimulating and will whet your appetite for the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought coming up in June 2021. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.